Welcome to the Reality Revolution. I'm your host, Brian Scott. I'm so excited today. We're going to talk about accessing and experiencing other realities. If you've had a chance to read my book, you'll know that that is the fundamental reason behind this podcast was I had a sort of traumatic event, which pushed me into what I felt was an alternate reality than my own. And I began to experiment with accessing other realities, something I had begun much, much earlier. My first experience in accessing an alternate reality was, in my memory, most likely in college when I had tried LSD. And at first, just became aware of all those music videos that I had seen and different designs and started to see patterns moving, and then had sort of extrasensory experiences where I was absolutely sure I was in another dimension or another world. After that, I sought this out like chasing the dragon, trying to figure out a way to access these other realities, and really became an explorer in consciousness, trying everything that I could find, breathing techniques, different meditation modalities, self-hypnosis. I would try flotation tanks and meditation helmets and light programs and anything that I could possibly do. I've documented it on other episodes, 20 different ways to access parallel realities. And it is very, very fascinating to research the history of the magical experience and how we've been trying to access and experience other realities all along. And I wanted to discuss this today to further explore the history of the magical experience going all the way back to indigenous and medieval and modern magic. Lynn Hume, in her book, The Varieties of Magical Experiences, says that humans seem to have an innate yearning for something other than our physical world and our brief existence in the physical form. This has led to myths and religious beliefs that try to offer us something more than the stark notion that once our physical body dies, we cease to exist. There is nothing. We long to discover this other world, and we have to come up with all sorts of innovative and creative ways to explore it. In Irish mythology, the other world has been described in poetry and tales as being a land of paradise, happiness, and summer. It was a place where there was no sickness, death, or even old age. It is often described as a series of islands where the various deities and ancestors live, and many of the mythological heroes journey to these realms. The hero might set out on a quest, and at some time a magic mist might descend upon him. On passing through, and after many adventures, he returns to his mortal abode, and is from that time changed. Irish tradition recounts tales of fairies and their dwelling places in mounds and hollow hills where they live in communities ruled by a king or a queen. Their places might be found by humans at certain times of the year, most often midsummer. I definitely recommend you check out the book by Frederick Dodson called Levels of Heaven and Hell, really exploring different dimensions on a spiritual level in relation to how we have always defined heaven and hell, the higher and lower planes of consciousness. Discussing the other world further, in some traditions, this other world that Hume is talking about is referred to as the underworld, a region that is thought to be beneath the earth, a surface, a place where the souls of the newly dead go, and is sometimes known by the realm of death. Other worlds, underworlds, or inner worlds seem to be varying explanations for the places that humans go when they die, from the physical world and where they might venture at times during their lives. According to prophetic and devotional traditions, the Prophet Muhammad was miraculously transported from Mecca to Jerusalem one night in the company of the angel Gabriel. In several versions, his magical flight is described as mounting a ladder to the sky. Lao Tzu, the legendary founder of Chinese Taoism, is said to have left his body inert and lifeless in order to go for a stroll to the origin of things. In some Taoist sects, an essential mark of the holy man is the ability to take flight and wander freely through enchanted islands, sacred mountains, or celestial spheres. In Christian thought, some refer to the notion of both heaven and hell as metaphorical places, while others view heaven as a more tangible place that is full of the presence of saints. Heaven is referred to by Christ as a kingdom, Matthew 25:34. In Acts 14:22, it is called the kingdom of God. In 2 Corinthians 12:2, it is referred to as the third heaven, and in Deuteronomy 10:14, it is called the heaven of heavens, implying that there are layers or levels of heaven, not just one. In the book of Revelation, heaven is described as being a city resplendent with brilliant gems, crystals, gold, and other precious stones. And for those fortunate enough to arrive in heaven, there shall no longer be any night, and they shall not have need of light of a lamp, nor the light of the sun, because the Lord God shall illumine them. Revelation 22:5. Hell, on the other hand, is a place of darkness, completely devoid of God's mercy and goodness. It is full of terrors, a furnace of unquenchable fire, a place of everlasting punishment where its victims are tormented in both their bodies and their minds, in accordance with their sinful natures, and there is much weeping and gnashing of teeth, Matthew 13:49-50. Those lost in the flames of hell will endure the most intense pain and suffering they have ever felt, according to this literature. Christians might catch a glimpse of heaven during a near-death experience. Jane Smith stepped into a subtly illuminated flower meadow, saturated with colors she had never seen before. Other visitors to the heavenly regions have also commented on the colors. One man spoke of them as the colors of utopia, the perfect originals of which earthly hues are only a copy. Verdant lawns, pure blue sky and lakes, and a mixed palette of flowers and rainbows. The other world is ornamented with the colors of precious metals and jewels mined from the Empyrean. In both medieval and modern near-death narratives, paradise topography frequently refers to pastoral meadows, seraphic choirs, golden gates, shining cities, angelic music, and etheric smiling beings all surrounded with light. While heaven is for people who accept God, hell is for people who reject God, according to this literature. The way into heaven is through God's grace, and to avoid hell is through Jesus, who died for human sins, according to the Christian literature. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the light," in the Acts of John 95:26-27. Jesus Christ is quoted by John as saying, "I am a door to you who knock on me. I am a way to you, the traveler." Many Christian faiths have interpreted these words as necessitating the following of Christian dogma and doctrine. The Gnostics, however, had something a little different to say. The early Gnostics argued that one's own experience is the ultimate criterion of truth and takes precedence over all traditions and secondhand testimony. According to the Gospel of Thomas, 32:19-33.5, and I will probably read the Gospel of Thomas sometime in the future for the podcast if enough people say in the comments for me to read it. One of the Gospels that was omitted from the New Testament, Jesus proclaimed the kingdom of God as being inside and outside. The kingdom is inside of you, and it is outside of you. When you come to know yourselves, then you will be known, and you will realize that you are the sons of the living Father. But if you will not know yourselves, then you dwell in poverty. Elaine Pagel suggests the term kingdom symbolizes a state of transformed consciousness. The Gnostics insisted that it was only on the basis of immediate experience that one could create the poems, visions, accounts, myths, and hymns that they prized as proof of the attainment of Gnosis. From many accounts and myths and legends, religious writings and personal narrations throughout history, life in the physical world is connected to other planes of existence. And it is possible to move into those planes. Check out my book, The Reality Revolution, The Mind-Blowing Movement to Hack Your Reality, where I talk about the many ways that you can travel from this physical world into other realities and the concept of quantum jumping. The passage from one to the other might be serendipitous, or it might be attained using certain techniques. There are a variety of techniques once you understand how it works. The spiritual journeyer may have to surmount obstacles such as guarded doorways, walls of fire, mazeways, curtains of mist, and caves lined with teeth, and face many ordeals within certain dimensions and dreamlike realms. Having penetrated the impasse, however, the person may then feel oneness with the universe, meet an illuminated or enlightened being, or gain knowledge that is unattainable on the earthly plane. According to Amerindian cosmology, there are three levels to the universe: sky, earth, and underworld, all connected by a central axis. Moving from one world to the next is often represented by moving through an opening or a hole. All things are part of a unified universe, and each level, with its particular qualities and energies, interacts with and interpenetrates the other. There are no limits between the world of animals, humans, and spirits. They are one, and the universe is perceived as a live entity. You can also refer to the Law of One material that outlines the seven different densities, indicating that each of those densities is really another reality. We're in the third density. We began in the first density as the tiniest of molecules and bacteria, moving up into amoebas and cells, and then becoming insects, and moving from insects into second density beings like dogs and cats, then moving into third density beings like human beings, and then fourth density, and fifth and sixth and seventh density, moving into eighth density. Each of those densities is an entirely different realm of reality. Just like the octaves on a piano. Now, in order to access other realities, people in different cultures and religions across the world use very similar methods. And they're used by spiritual specialists, spiritual seekers, whether or not they have any particularly religious belief, and even by the merely curious. One or all of the senses might be involved. Visual signs and symbols might be employed, as well as voice and musical instruments, dance or body postures with accompanying body decoration of some sort, physical pain, and olfactory and tactile stimuli. Sometimes hallucinogenic substances are used. As part of his fieldwork in Nepal among the Tibetan Buddhist Yokino Sherpa people, anthropologist Robert Dejaris became an apprentice to a healer. With Mem's help, began his own forays into trance experiences, stating, "Taking the role of shamanic initiate, I would sit in a semi-lotus position to the right of my guru and attempt to follow the curing chants. In time, Mem would begin to feel the presence of the divine, his body oscillating in fits and tremors, and my body, following the rhythm of his actions, would similarly shake, tracked by the driving, insistent beat of the shaman's drum. My body would fill with energy. Music resonated within me, building to a crescendo, charging my body and the room with impacted meaning. Waves of tremors coursed through my limbs. Sparks flew. Colors expanded. The room came alive with voices, fire, laughter, and darkness." After several months of learning how to use his body in a similar way to the people he was studying, taking note of their ways of approaching smells and sounds, ways of talking, walking, and sensing, over time, his trance experiences slowly began to be more comparable to those that his teacher experienced. The more experience he gained of trance, the more controlled, centered, and steady were the visions he was having, and he realized that it is possible to expand one's field of awareness to a much greater extent. Trance induction appears to be universal, from Western Pentecostal services to Islam-based Sufi ecstatic circles to the Kalahari Sun in South Africa, and it's intensely emotional. There are some basic techniques that employ the senses in order to open what Aldous Huxley referred to as the doors of perception, or knowledge that is different from that achieved via intellect and reason. These techniques enable a person to move into a trance state that mostly necessitates blocking the logical, rational thought process, what yogis call stopping the oscillations of the mind and being open to non-mundane experiences. Sometimes, by focusing on a visual device such as a mandala, a mirror, or a pool of water, or a repetitive sound such as drumming or rattling, or by wearing a mask, one can achieve a sense of passing from one state of consciousness to another. These are visual and auditory gateways, but there are other methods. What seems to be essential to the majority of experiences of alternate reality is to move into an alternate state, or ASC. In an alternate state, the experience becomes reality rather than merely an exercise using the imagination. An important point to bear in mind when considering experiences in altered states is that they are almost always interpreted through specific cultural and religious symbols, language, and belief, and the original experience may change considerably in the relaying of it. For example, a woman once told Lynn Hume that she had seen leprechauns when she visited Ireland. On pressing the woman to tell her more about what they looked like, they were wearing red jackets and green pants. Did they have beards? The woman replied, no. They were small lights that moved across the floor of the room she was in and did not really have any form. Trance may be accompanied by visions and can be induced by dance, music, hypnosis, rapid overbreathing, inhaling substances, ingesting hallucinogens, and ascetic contemplation or deep meditation, prolonged immobility, fasting, sleep deprivation, and even self-inflicted injury can produce a trance state, as can participating in numinous moments such as rituals, initiations, or seances, as well as various privations, ordeals, harassment, social isolation, and sensory deprivation can produce a trance state. Rhythmic and incessant clapping the hands together and stomping the feet in the company of others in a ceremonial setting with auditory stimuli can lead to trance. The key to bringing about a change in consciousness appears to be in the continuous and sustained use of any method in an emotional and/or meaningful setting. Both sensory deprivation and sensory overstimulation can result in a trance state. An Ogallala Sioux man cited by Thomas Lewis commented on his experience while participating in the Sun Dance, a ceremony calling on the power and healing properties of the sun, which is performed among many indigenous people of the plains in North America. The experience of the Sun Dance, I can't describe it. It's like being hypnotized as I go up and down, as if the sun were dancing. It is a good feeling. It is all preparation, planning, testing, being ready. It is not easy. My throat is dry and I'm tired. I don't sleep before. I cannot sleep. I'm thinking and planning how it will be. There is sacrifice, pain, death, dying, coming back again to the real world. Fasting and purification before an actual dance might last from 48 hours to 4 days, and extreme forms of the dance might include self-torturous infliction of pain on the physical body of the dancer, piercing, the insertion of skewers into the flesh before being tied to a rope that is hanging from a central pole. The dancer might continue the dance until the skewers are torn free. The ultimate goal of a sun dance is the religious experience of a vision. It is also an empowering experience for the dancer, who gains some understanding of the complementarity of life and death, and that suffering is part of life. It also helps the dancer to cope with the realities of everyday life. If the dancer receives a vision during the several days of the Sundance activities, his spirit might leave the body and converse with one or more other spirits receive power and be instructed by them in how to use that power. A dancer might channel his power during prayer and dance in order to help sick relatives or friends. For both participants and spectators, to Sundance, especially in its extreme form, is a powerful emotional and spiritual experience replete with electrifying energy within a highly charged setting. The movement of whirling, as practiced in the Medvedi tradition of Sufism and also entailed in the first exercise of the Five Tibetans, is a ceremony of worship that involves the dancer performing the soma, which means to listen. While listening to uplifting music, the dancer, the whirling dervish, experiences the meaning of those words from the Holy Quran: wherever you turn is the face of God. The dancer unifies with others in a circular dance that is focused on his spiritual longing for God in complete surrender. The dancer's thoughts and his body are concentrated on God's presence. He inwardly repeats the name of God while maintaining awareness of the precise manner of whirling that enables him to spin on his own physical axis, revolving 360 degrees with each step and focusing on his deep love of God. The soma, or sema, is said to carry the dancer beyond the usual universe of existence to the truth. Hyperexcitation, such as experienced in the North American Sundance, in the Balinese Christdance, or the West African Spirit Ceremony, leads to experiences phenomenologically different from those induced by hyperrelaxation, such as Zen meditation. Certain meditation techniques that reduce sensory input, for example, the monotonous but mellifluous repetition of a mantra in an otherwise silent setting, can lead to light trance that becomes deeper the longer it is repeated. Often trance is accompanied by bodily shaking. For example, in Kenya, the Samburu men, poised between boyhood and mature male, regularly go into trance, shaking their whole bodies. The Shakers and the early Quakers were often beset by uncontrollable body shaking and trance states achieved in emotionally charged church services. These instances were regarded as mystical and a manifestation of the Holy Spirit. Shaking, trembling, and convulsions are characteristic of the preliminary stages of possession and trance to Haitian voodoo ceremonies prior to the spirit's entry into the dancer's body, when they are said to ride their earthly hosts like a horse. They are often unaware of what they are doing. Some American Black Baptist churches in places like New Orleans exhibit bodily trembling and epileptic-like states after highly charged emotional singing. In the 15th century, there was a curious spate of dance mania that swept through Italy in the wake of the Black Death, called Tarantism, because it was rumored by the frenetic and abandoned dancers had been subjected to the poisonous bite of a tarantula spider. People would dance, shout, scream, and sometimes foam at the mouth. Some had apocalyptic visions and saw visions of Jesus and the Virgin Mary. Some were seized by epileptic-like reactions. In some regions, it was thought to be caused by demonic possession. Those affected would dance themselves into trance and then collapse exhausted. Peasant Italians in the 15th century regularly danced to the music of the fifes, clarinets, and drums. And the hyper-excitation that occurred during the Tarantism dances was thought to be due to the dispersion of the spider's poison through the body of the dancer. Trance dance can use a combination of techniques: body movement, sound, percussive rhythm, and breathing techniques in order to focus on healing and the possible experiences of discovering parallel realities. One contemporary trance dancer, Robbie Robertson, who used the aforementioned techniques with the addition of being blindfolded, writes, "Imagine darkness so intense and so complete, covering you like a velvet blanket. A blackness that cuts you off from the everyday world, forcing you to draw deep into yourself, a blackness that makes you see with your heart instead of your eyes. You can't see, but your eyes seem open. You are isolated, but you know you are united with all living things. And out of this darkness comes the roaring of the drums, the sound of the prayers, And among these sounds, your ears catch the voices of the spirits, ghost-like, whispering to you from unseen lips. You feel the wings of birds brushing your face and feel the light touch of a feather on your skin. And always you hear the throbbing drums filling the empty space inside yourself, making you forget things that clutter your mind, making your body sway to their rhythm. The interpretation of experiences in altered states depends to a great extent on situating the experience within a cultural and/or religious cognitive framework. A similar somatic experience might translate as a divine revelation or an encounter with devas, or it might be interpreted as a mental disorder to some cultures. Experiences are encouraged and others are discouraged. As people move into altered states, they may experience physical sensations of corporeal shrinkage or expansion, which may be accompanied by a feeling of lightness or rising up. Sometimes this lightness turns into a sensation of flying and or becoming transformed into another creature, especially a bird, at which time visual perceptions indicate a sense of looking down from above. At other times, they may feel as if they are being drawn into a vortex, perhaps a tunnel, and they may experience physical constrictions and breathing difficulties. The physical body may begin to vibrate, sounds may be heard, and a bright light or lights may be seen. Sri Ramakrishna, a Hindu who performed priestly duties in a temple of Kali, the divine mother in India in the 19th century, wrote that he heard clattering sounds in his joints and felt that he had no power to move his body. He then started to see a vision of particles of light like swarms of fireflies, then masses of light covering everything like a mist. Visualization is a method that is used in many practices. The Vajrayana tradition of Buddhism involves an intense visualization training based on a series of elaborate icons that must be successfully reproduced in full detail in the mind's eye. During meditation practice, the more highly detailed the images, colors, implements, hand gestures, posture, which all symbolizes different aspects of the path to spiritual fulfillment that one can hold in one's mind, the more successful is the visualization. Focusing attention on a mental image of an enlightened being such as Tara or Avalokiteshvara is recommended as a means of developing single-pointed concentration. If one selects Tara for the exercise, the practitioner might imagine her body as emerald green light, translucent and radiant, dressed in clothing of celestial silk and adorned with precious gems. She could be seated in a spiritually meaningful posture, holding a blue flower and smiling lovingly at the meditator. The visualization could include thoughts of Tara's inexhaustible loving kindness and of opening one's heart to this energy. The aim is to produce a positive, joyful, meditative experience and to remind the meditator of the experience of enlightenment until it becomes a living reality. An old idea that is found in cultures as far apart as India and Alaska is that thoughts are mental images that have form and, when projected out into the etheric field, become realities themselves. In the Western esoteric system, thoughts, images, and vibrations are said to produce tangible forms that can become visible to those with psychic abilities. Fink suggests that mental images can stimulate visual processing mechanisms, directly activating many of the same information processing mechanisms that are activated during ordinary visual perception, resulting in the person seeing an imagined object just as vividly and clearly as if it were the real object. So if someone sees or experiences spirit, it is as real as anything that he or she might experience in the mundane world. Both experiences are valid and real to the perceiver. Mental images that are enhanced by concentration and will, using techniques such as creative visualization, can project an image from the mind's eye to one that is projected outside the individual. This practice, whether explicit or implicit, is the experiential core of many mystical and magical religious traditions. To become proficient at visualization, certain exercises are recommended. An image held in the mind's eye is cultivated so that the image itself can be projected from the mind and seen outside the imagination. With practice, the mere thought of the emotion associated with the form will evoke, in the waking consciousness, the symbol form concerned, and conversely, the symbol will evoke the emotion until the proficient practitioner can directly perceive things on the astral levels or astral planes without the need for symbols. One exercise to enhance this process is to close the eyes and imagine the face of a familiar person. Picture the shape, color, texture of the face. Hold the image for as long as possible, then project the image onto a blank wall. The aim is to create such a strong image that it can be seen with the eyes open. Successful magical work, right? Two modern Western magic practitioners, W.E. Butler and Israel Regardi, requires the ability to build up mental images. The magician learns to train the mind's eye in order to evoke images so that the force or energy at the energy form can be used for magical purposes. Another technique is to imagine a particular god form, for example, Isis, surrounding and coinciding with one's own physical body. While breathing rhythmically, the name of the god is frequently vibrated for some time. As concentration becomes more intense and profound, the force is said to become visualized by streams of dynamic energy and power, and the mind is invaded by light, intense feelings, and inspiration. Other sensory modalities, hearing, smell, taste, and touch, can be enhanced with training techniques that are similar to those employed for image enhancements. Training for heightened audible sensitivity, for example, can't be done through the use of gradually diminishing sound, and the projection of audible forms is assisted by using aids such as large seashells. The advanced adept becomes familiar with these practices until there is a shift in consciousness, and this state can be attained at will. In Islamic Sufi cosmology, there are five hierarchical planes of being called presences, or hadarat. On each of the planes, there is a bi-unity of action and passion. Each lower presence is the image and correspondence, the mithal. The reflection and mirror of the next higher is in the way everything that exists in the physical world of the senses is a reflection of what exists in the world of spirits. It is important for the Sufi to attain a balance between the inner and outer dimensions, and so activities are directed toward emptying the mind of worldly preoccupations in order to be deeply plunged in the ardent love of God, to the extent that thoughts are completely centered on God. In order to remember that which is known but forgotten, the Sufi needs to invoke recollection, or zikir. When the mind is emptied of all other thoughts and with God as the absolute focus, one is more likely to attain the goal of remembering. This can be achieved by listening profoundly with the ear of the heart to music or poetry, or engaging in recitation or other activities that lead one to the same goal. One such recitation is God is with me, God watches me, God witnesses me. And this is repeated over and over again each night until a sweetness manifests in the heart. The Sufi is also advised to stay responsive to divine communication and to keep the heart in a constant state of alertness. Visualization is very important to this endeavor, and there are specific exercises to practice in order to gain proficiency. The faithful need to imagine God as present and must attain intuitive vision or visualization. They should contemplate God in the subtle center, which is the heart, while simultaneously hearing the divine voice vibrating in all manifesting things to the extent that nothing else is heard. The Sufi says, "When he shows himself to me, my whole being is vision. When he speaks to me in secret, my whole being is hearing." Visions to Ibn Arabi and his followers, whether they are experienced in a waking or dream state, are themselves penetrations into the world of another dimension. Another exercise is to recite the name Allah, or the Arabic names of God mentioned in the Quran, while employing breath control techniques. While techniques and possibly the core experiences are very similar across many different religious traditions, the focus and interpretive frameworks are very diverse. This explains why seeing a light might be interpreted as specific deity, iconic religious figure, or an enlightened being, and so on, or as proof of the veracity of a believer's religious doctrines. Rudolf Arnheim writes that a person's direct observation is an exploration of the form-seeking, form-imposing mind, which needs to understand but cannot until it casts what it sees into manageable models. Intense concentration upon a particular symbol can center the mind, stimulate non-analytical modes of knowing, and operate as a door or passageway. Interpenetration depends upon cultural conditioning and religious background. We would be highly unlikely to see something with which we were entirely unfamiliar in any way. Intense devotion to an icon of the Virgin Mary may produce a vivid and highly significant experience for a Roman Catholic or a veve, ground drawing usually made in cornmeal associated with a particular spirit, for a practitioner of voodoo, or a tarot card image for a Western occultist, but would not result in the same experience across these traditions unless there was familiarity in the appropriate context. Music, and many of the religious communities discussed in the collection of articles in Sullivan's edited book, Enchanting Powers, comment upon the enchanting power of religious music and its ability not only to attune itself to other realities, but to provoke other realities into resonating in tune with it. In medieval Java, for example, where tantric practices were maintained after long years of study with a spiritual guide, focused yet relaxed listening to certain kinds of music was believed to be a vehicle of transportation to the mystic union with deity or for the descent of a personal deity. Drumming, chanting, magical words, sound vibrations, and emotional songs that uplift the soul can act as a means to transcendence. Having one's ears open to the significance of sound is highly significant to the Songhe of Niger, as Paul Stoller discovered when he became an apprentice to a sorcerer. The Songhe believed that sound is a phenomenon in and of itself and is the carrier of powerful forces. Words not only convey knowledge or information, but they are also power and energy themselves. Indeed, Stoller's fieldwork experiences led him to believe that words have power and the sound is very powerful indeed. People who undergo a profound Christian religious conversation say that no words can do justice to such an experience. A Pentecostal service where members feel they have encountered the presence of Jesus would not be possible without the highly charged emotions that are engendered by the music. The musical instruments, uplifting emotional songs, and impassioned words of the preacher produce a heightened or ecstatic state in the worshipers during which the presence of the divine can be keenly felt. Pentecostal services are a communal affair with the fundamental aim to construct an atmosphere in which they may consciously and intuitively encounter God, which is often expressed as a felt presence of the divine. Music functions as an auditory icon, embracing and surrounding each of the worshipers. People may have a sense of being inspired to speak or act, or more dramatically, of being acted upon or seized by the divine and being infused by the Holy Spirit. The interweaving of music and emotion in Pentecostal groups is particularly fine-tuned, bringing about heightened emotions in most of the people present and resulting in desired outcomes of healing, prophecy, and glossolalia, all of which are regarded as a sign of the presence of Jesus. Songs or chants accompanied by music or not can be employed to evoke intense emotional experiences in singers and listeners alike, and are used to great effect in charismatic Christian churches. Also among the Sufis, repetitive prayer and movement can break through barriers so that the Sufis feel they are in the presence of God. Certain instruments such as drums, universally identified as a potent element of emotionally charged rituals, and the more culturally specific didgeridoo can trigger the same sort of transformations and lead to intense emotional and physiological changes. The drum is used cross-culturally to move audiences into an altered state. Anthropologist T.R. Miller reports that the drums and rattles of the Siberian shaman, for example, promote spectral shifts between inner and outer auditory perception, and that sounds moved in oral streams between foreground and background, between inner and outer soundscapes, between memory and the present, between music, language, and noise. The sounds and vibrations of both voices and drums reverberate in bodies and in acoustical spaces occupied by performers and listeners, serving to link mere mortals with the spirits. In a ceremonial performance known as Kamlani, The Siberian shaman's drum symbolizes an animal that aided the shaman in his journeys to other realms. The drum was often placed between the legs of the drummer, and he would ride it as if it were a horse. The drum also gathered together the shaman's spirit helpers. Drumming is an intrinsic part of trance in voodoo ceremonies. Drummers undergo long and intense training before they are experienced enough to perform in a ceremony that calls on the spirits, when the servitor or dancer becomes the vessel for the spirits. It is said that the spirit is mounting or riding the possessed person, causing him or her to fall into an uncontrolled frenzy, at which time other participants in the ceremony need to ensure that the possessed person does not injure himself or herself. The wild dancing and excitement of the ritual performance promoted by drumming indicates that the dancer has been possessed. There are drum patterns that correspond to certain spirits, and drumming variations assist and facilitate specific spirits to enter into the servitor's body during the ritual. Without the drumming, it is unlikely that a voodoo ceremony would take place, so inextricably linked is the dancer with the drumming. In Papua New Guinea, the Kaluli people also recognize the important link between drumming, emotions, and somatic experience. The Kaluli believe that everything, including objects such as a drum, has a visible realm and outside, and a reflection realm and inside. One is the deeper reality of the other. The intention of ceremonial drumming is for listeners to reflect on that deeper reality and acknowledge that sound is always more than it appears to be. The drum is said to have resonant carrying power, and when it begun to pulsate strongly, drummers feel the pulsing sensation in their upper arms and chest, as well as in the lower hands and fingers. The Pitjant Jajara in Central Australia uses a continuous stick beating accompanying known as a Tukul Tinganyai, which is said to follow the heartbeat. The Pitjant Jajara say that while breath controls the length of the phrase, the speed of singing and of beating is governed by listening to the heart. In the performance of songs, that name and therefore contains the power of important geographical and sacred sites. The singing is accompanied by the large, strong beating of sticks, timpil pulka. The expression inma pulka in kamaya, or singing in a strongly accented style, describes the performance, the ceremonial performance of an ancestor. And the mythological narrative that accompanies that performance links past and future simultaneously with the present. The didgeridoo is not present in all areas of Australia, but even in areas where it is found, music is primarily vocal and is built around short bursts of singing, the length governed by the physical endurance of the singer to maintain breath. Anthropologist David Turner discovered that the didgeridoo is much more than merely an instrument for producing sound, at least on Groote Eylandt in Australia. During his fieldwork, where he learned how to play the didgeridoo under the guidance of Groote Eylandt, a man named Gula, Turner was interested in the notion of high and low frequency sounds. He noted that some sounds charge the emotions and other sounds discharge the emotions. Tibetan Buddhist chanting, he noted, charges and discharges at the same time. The effect of didgeridoo playing, according to Turner, is like Tibetan chanting. It simultaneously charges and discharges and produces a paradoxical state of excited relaxation. Just as the sound of the didgeridoo is produced by breathing in and out at the same time, circular breathing, the effect of that sound is simultaneously dual, a meditative mind in an enlivened body. One time after about 4 hours of didgeridoo playing, Turner felt lightheaded, released of stress, and energized. When he played the music associated with Groote Eylandt mortuary ceremonies, he became very detached and peaceful and saw how playing might calm the emotions and assist in the grieving process. The didgeridoo is said to have considerable spiritual significance, as it helps to transport the spirit of the dead person over to the other side during mortuary ceremonies. It acts as a channel between this world and the next. One of Turner's informants told him that care has to be taken when playing some tunes, even those that are not secret or sacred, as they can summon up spirit substance that might run out of control if the instrument is not properly controlled. After having mastered the art of playing the didgeridoo in the way taught to him by Gula, Turner says that he gained an insider's insight into another world. One night after a particularly good performance of didgeridoo playing with the others, Turner had the experience of floating above the landscape and soaring over green patchwork fields, at which time he could see with extreme clarity. All that he surveyed in a way that he had never before experienced, it was not a dream, he insists. Sound vibrations are mentioned as being important in many parts of the world. A Songhay healer conveyed to Stroller that although the meaning of words and songs is important, it is the sound vibrations that are even more important. Similarly, chanting the names of Krishna using the mantra Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare Hare, known as the great chanting for the deliverance, is believed to set up a transcendental vibration that helps cleanse away misgivings of false consciousness and open up the possibility of spiritual understanding. The word Hare is the form of addressing the energy of the Lord, and the words Krishna and Rama are forms of addressing the Lord himself. Krishna consciousness is said to be original, natural energy of the living entity, and when devotees hear the transcendental vibration of the chant, this consciousness is revived. Through kirtan, a form of congregational chanting accompanied by percussion instruments and sometimes spontaneous dancing, the devotee associates with the divine via sound vibration, and this can develop into a mood of spontaneous devotional rapture. In the yogic traditions of meditation, a Sanskrit mantra is said to first calm the mind so that stillness can be experienced. And then through constant repetition, the syllabic resonance takes one deep into the energy centers or chakras. Sanskrit mantras are words of power considered to be essential for the internal journey of self-knowledge. Ian Prattis writes that the sound resonance of the mantra operates the total energy system. The syllables in a mantra act as a set of tonal frequencies that resonate with cellular templates and activate energy centers in the body, connecting and unifying them into a single integrated system. You can check out my 10-minute chakra meditation. I have one where I do all these chants. And in each of my chakra meditations, you will find these specific syllables being used. In Western occultism, audible perception can be enhanced by training in order to assist magical work. One of the contemporary magician W.E. Butler's techniques is to listen to a familiar voice reading something. Poetry is suggested. Then attempt to hear the sound of the poetry when the person is not reading it. Another technique is to vibrate names of power, say God names, when one is relaxed and breathing slowly and deeply. This can cause visual and audible images to arise, which can be used for purposes of communication between the conscious and superconscious levels of the person and lead to enhanced psychic abilities. The ideal magical chant is strongly rhythmical and appeals to the subconscious. Its reiteration must be made to rise and fall by change of key. The Gregorian chant is said to be highly efficacious in magical work. The British esoteric writer Colin Wilson once commented, "Mystical or poetic experience is somehow very simple, like drawing aside a curtain or turning on a light switch. But if you blunder into a completely dark room, you may feel the walls for hours before you find the switch. Turning on the light is simple when you know where the switch is." Some Westerners are not content to wait for the serendipitous magical experience, or to undertake the many years of arduous spiritual training recommended by most religious traditions and spiritual practices, but prefer instead to turn on the light switch straight away. Through the ingestion of psychoactive plants, now referred to as entheogens, generating experiences of the divine under their many and varied specifics, such as the traditional ayahuasca, peyote, soma, yage, kaipi, among others, and they can catapult the imbiber into the terra incognita of alien and plant realms. The experiencer enters alternate worlds and seeks engagement with plant spirits and other entities. Mazatec and Colombian shamans consider the world accessed through entheogens to be considerably more real than the ordinary physical world, that the everyday world is a pale echo of the other world. The exceptionally vibrant and vividly colored scenes of serpents, jungle creatures, and psychedelic geometric designs portrayed by Peruvian visionary Pueblo Amaringo attest to his experiences while under the influence of the ayahuasca brew, herb Salvia divinorum, used sacramentally by the Mazatec people in Oaxaca, central Mexico, takes the Western imbiber to what they call Salvia space. Any experience using Salvia depends upon the person taking it. One Western experimenter's first experience of smoking Salvia divinorum gave him the curious feeling of being transformed into the hem of a black, green, and purple velvet gown, which merged into a large revolving vinyl record. When he looked up, he saw that the wearer of the gown was a pale, stern woman with large dark eyes and black hair who seemed to be chastising him for wasting her time. Entheogenic users often say they enter a visionary landscape where they experience enhanced sensory acuity, complex ideation, great coherence of meaning, and transcendent emotion, that the landscape is often inhabited by discarnate entities who are willing to interact with the tripper. The user can experience body dissociation, a sense of transcending time and space, and experience a wide range of impressions, including formless vibration, strange plant-like forms, alien machines, intelligent entities, and otherworldly music and languages. Some experience the spirit world through DMT, dimethyltryptamine, a chemical that allows access through the K-hole into DMT hyperspace. Beings that are commonly encountered are mantis beings that look like praying mantises and a presiding intelligence called Lord Dimitri, or presence called Lady K, or elves. DMT hyperspace, explained, those who have ventured there is filled with various creatures, some of whom look like aliens as popularly depicted, with two large almond-shaped eyes and a pear-shaped head. Others have the appearance of insects, but there are many other beings. The experience, writes Tremachi, is characteristically both awe-inspiringly mysterious and strangely familiar, and the meanings and the feeling tones evoked in the partaker have enormous impact on the person. There's growing literature on both the emic and etic perspectives of entheogens, their use and experiences of those taking them. Rather than taking the classical pathological or psychological approach to the whole area of analytical discourse about entheogens, Andy Lechter employs an animistic discourse which suggests that consciousness-altering substances are not merely altering perception of the world, but they allow the partaker to attempt to forge relationships with actual discarnate entities or intelligences. This accords with Aldous Huxley's thoughts on the matter, that psychedelics strip away the mind's filtering mechanisms, which subsequently permit one to perceive that which is not normally perceived in the manner of tuning in to some signal from outside the person. Both Huxley and Lechter consider that in the spirit realm, or realms in which plants and other spirits have agency, consciousness, and awareness, is a reality in itself. Lechter's own experiences with psilocybin or magic mushrooms, he says, had a profound spiritual and ontological impact on him personally. Similarly, Daniel Pinchbeck writes how his personal experiences with magic mushrooms completely shattered his skeptical worldview, and he became convinced that trees are watchers, plants are sentient beings, patiently aware of their place in the ultimate scheme of things. Rick Strassman's search for a biological basis for spiritual experiences led him to conduct intensive research on psychedelic drug experimentation. He suggests that our brain chemistry allows us to access other realms of existence, and hypothesizes that DMT, which is naturally produced by the pineal gland, facilitates the soul's movement in and out of the body, and is an integral part of the birth and death experience, meditation, and even sexual transcendence. He points out that there are both dangers and promises to drug-induced spiritual experiences, and while one person might soar, full of ecstatic and insightful discoveries one day, that same person might struggle through a terrifying nightmare the next, and different people might suffer greatly from one experience. Devotion and intense concentration or heightened awareness, focused thought on the activity, whether that is prayer, uplifting songs, or playing or listening to music, the vibrations and sounds that affect body and mind, the notion of the existence of other, Whether a deity, another realm, a universal energy, and so on are factors that can be found universally in the accessing and experiencing of other realities. At the very foundation of all these beliefs and practices is the idea that there is much more than the reality of this physical world in which we live, and that it is possible to access different realities by using any or a combination of the methods discussed. So I refer you again back to my book, The Reality Revolution, and I give some very powerful techniques that you can use to enter into other realities. Yes, DMT and ayahuasca and that stuff can be very powerful. In my own experience, it's like dipping your toe in the pool. You'll never be able to swim. Using basic meditational techniques, dance techniques, body movements, breathing is more than enough. Using visualization is more than enough. So check out my quantum jumping episodes. I have a quantum jump sleep meditation. I have a short quantum jump. I have a number of different quantum jump videos that you can watch. And that has been the most powerful that I have found, doing basic exercises like the five Tibetans or yoga, so that you can feel the energies moving through your spine. And then really focusing on the reality that you want to enter into, or opening yourself up to alternate realities. And then using breathing, in addition to Qigong exercises, to bring up the energy in your body, to really expand on it. In my own experience, I have found sudden bursts of energy are the most powerful way of traveling to another reality cleanly, without any alteration to your own consciousness, meaning that you're not drunk or high on a specific drug. You can still use those things, and those things are teachers and open different portals into different dimensions. But if you're wanting to enter into other realities, quantum jumping is a great place to start. Going into your own meditative space, clearing out your mind, and it allows you to understand your subconscious and understand the way that you create reality. And in the process, it becomes a spiritual way of actually connecting to God and the oneness of all. So I hope that you find some wonderful, glorious realities and magical experiences in your near future. This gives us a little history and a journey through some of the different religions and indigenous practices that have brought about these magical experiences for other cultures. Everything is fit through your own cultural mindset. When you look at these things, you're carrying your own definitions and you're filtering an understanding of these experiences. By understanding it through other cultures, maybe, just maybe, you get a better understanding of what's actually happening. There are other realities all around us that can be accessed from your own consciousness on a regular basis through both body motion and meditation, through sounds and through images. You can activate these realities. There's so many different ways. And I do suggest reading in magical literature. If you're not into magic, that is the place where experimentation is constantly being done in accessing and manipulating different realities. This just gives you a sort of introduction to the idea of it and a further exploration of changing dimensions and realities by looking at different religious practices. In any case, you can find all episodes of The Reality Revolution at therealityrevolution.com. And welcome to the Reality Revolution.